A different day, a different porch. We lost power at our Chicago 3 flat, so we moved in with the boys to their place. We brought some food, but when we opened the fridge door, we saw that there was no room in the fridge. It was full with beer, and there was a bag of ketchup packets. To be young, 25, in the city. And, you know, before I forget, happy birthday, George Soros. Yeah, happy birthday, George. So what about those barking dogs of politics? Smash a window on Michigan Avenue with a rock. A Burberry window. You know, I bought a trench coat there. And then use another rock to try to smash the head of a police sergeant. Get arrested for felony aggravated battery of a police officer and criminal damage to property in that mass looting that happened downtown a few days ago. And guess what happens? You're in court. You've got one of those Judge Tim Evans approved bond judges. And you walk out posting only $500 for bond. Isn't that nice? We'll ask our guest today, Paul Vallis, a guy who could have been mayor if it weren't for the Daleys and the Joyces, a guy who should have been governor instead of Blagojevich. Vallis is coming on strong lately, posting criticisms of Mayor Lori Lightfoot's handling of the violence and the police issues, and Lightfoot getting rolled by CTU for closing schools. And we're going to find out what Paul thinks. And have you heard about all those sound bites? You know, the ones on Kamala Harris, whichever. I want to get it right before November. Because now that Joe Biden has chosen her as his vice presidential running mate, you're going to hear all the relevant sound bites. Harris says she believes that woman who accused Joe Biden of sexual assault.
I believe them, and I respect them being able to tell their story and having the courage to do it.
Do you believe that the vice president should enter this race?
He's going to have to make that decision for himself. I wouldn't tell him what to do.
And there was that other Tulsi Gabbard soundbite from the debate about Harris throwing people in jail for drug crimes while laughing about smoking pot. And there was Harris ripping Biden in their debate, saying he worked with those Southern Democratic segregationists against school busing. And she was that little girl. Remember? I was that little girl, she said. She had the t-shirts ready even before she said it. It was set up. It was phony, yes. But, you know, okay, she is a politician. And it worked for a while. She was up there, in the lead or right at the top. And then she faded away. But now? Now if you criticize her for the things she said, you'll be called a racist. And if you dare mention how she climbed the political ladder with the help of powerful men like California's Willie Brown, you'll be condemned as a sexist. They'll scream at you behind their hate has no home here signs. But that's politics. And politics is about cynicism, too. What is stunning is that she couldn't win the Democratic Party primary. But if Biden is elected president, Kamala Harris could be president any time after his inauguration. Like the day after. Or like right after his speech. The people around her and the people around Biden know who he is now. An old man babbling. The eyes growing vacant. You wouldn't hire him to watch your kids or watch your business. But they want to hire him to be president. They don't care. This is about power. It's always been about power. And the cynicism is right out there in your face. This is the deal. Elect him, you elect her. The vice presidency was once called nothing but a warm bucket of spit. Actually, the one who said it didn't say it was spit, but something else. And now it's different. A signal with cynicism so profound that we haven't really gripped it yet. But you will. Jeff Carlin is here, the executive producer of the Rokan Show on WGN Radio, and my friend. And Paul Vallis is here. Former candidate for mayor of Chicago, former governor, boss of the Chicago schools, a school reformer and innovator. And I'm John Cass. Husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board. And where are you? Between the smashing of the Burberry store and Kim Fox and Lori Lightfoot, squabbling but not saying each other's name, and Paul Vallis here talking about it, and Kamala Harris running for president without running for president. You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
Before we begin, everybody, you should know that two things. If you like what you listen to here on the Chicago Way, find us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you find your free podcasts, subscribe and tell all of your friends. And write us a kick-ass review on iTunes if you can. And I swear to God, I will not bribe you. And the second thing, and the most important thing is, I wanted to ask Jeff. Jeff, we've been getting a lot of email of support and notes from readers of support for you, for your family, after the loss of your mom, Jan, that you talked about last time. And I wonder if you wanted to say anything to them.
Yeah, no, John, absolutely. I got a lot of really good support that I wasn't necessarily expecting. And I have to thank everybody who sent cards and notes on Facebook, and the great Kristen McQuarrie, who sent me a lovely gift basket out of the blue. And she's so sweet. Yeah. My focus has really been on my dad. And so I really haven't had a lot of time to focus on myself, but having all that support really helped and kind of filled that gap of me taking care of myself for a bit. So I really appreciate it. Everybody's been, you know, support's been amazing, and it's a tough time, and it's one of those things you're never really ready for, and you kind of just take day by day, but the support really helps. So thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Jeff. And again, we all love you, man. I mean, we're all friends here. We're sitting around on our porches listening. I hope some of you has a cigar. Somebody has a drink. People have been writing into me saying, love listening to this, and with a cigar and a scotch. And you know what? I would love to have a cigar right now, but I can't do it from my kid's apartment. And right now we're going to be talking, as I said earlier in the podcast, to Paul Vallis. He's got things to say about Lori Lightfoot, about Chicago police, about looting, and prosecutions, and being prepared, because you always want to be prepared. Here's Paul. My friend, fellow Southsider, grew up working for his dad and getting fired from his dad at the at the diner and at the restaurants. I got fired at the grocery stores. Hey, good morning, Paul.
Good morning. You said go back to school.
Yeah, and you did, and I didn't. So, so listen. Over the past several weeks now, Paul Vallis, who should have been governor, he would have been mayor if it hadn't been for the Daleys and the Joyces playing a game on him, so much for people that you thought were your friends. Paul Vallis has been coming out strong, Jeff Carlin, talking about schools, talking about crime, the looting and all that. And he has a post on Facebook, on his Facebook page, that's lighting up. It's called The City Burns, The Mayor Goes to a Ribbon Cutting. What about this, Paul? What is going on? Are you running for mayor?
No. You know, look, I entered the race for two reasons. One is it was clear that they were going to try to arrange things, so to speak, so Emmanuel never really had any opposition. And you shouldn't be surprised. The idea was to have multiple African-American candidates in the race, and then there were no Latinos entered the race. And I think I entered after Willie Wilson, and I became kind of a wild card, because if you remember that early polling, I actually was doing pretty well, and they had me in a runoff, and they had me beating him. So I think it kind of upset the apple cart. But I ran because I did not, and of course, you know, the Emmanuel drops out, and then six other people enter the race. But I also ran because I really felt that the campaign needed to address issues. And I spent a better part of a year really clearly prioritizing what I thought to be the critical problems, and then of course offering my ideas and my solutions. So just because the election is over, I'm going to continue to do what I did, what I set out to do early on, which was to really try to think through the problems that the city's trying to address, and to offer a serious, legitimate solutions to those problems. And as a citizen, as someone who was born and raised in Chicago, I'm going to continue to do that. So I'm not running for anything, as much as I feel that as a citizen, I'm going to continue to comment on issues of great concern and of great relevancy, and I'm going to continue to try to offer substantive solutions to the problems we're facing.
Well, I don't see Bill Daley, the Jeremiah Joyce son, Jerry, Susana Mendoza, Gary Chico, anyone else talking about what's going on in Chicago that was of that group, but you are. Tell me, what did you think of the mayor's response to the mass looting that happened in Chicago just a few days ago downtown, with all those people in their condos looking down and wondering why did they spend $1 million to buy a condo?
Well, I think for the second time in recent months, the mayor was caught unprepared. You know, I think she was as equally unprepared, or as they were as equally unprepared for what happened as they were in the, in the initial riot that they had that created so much damage downtown. So it was like a repeat performance, and they were equally unprepared. They were late responding. They were late raising the bridges. They were late blocking the roads. They were trying to say that, they had picked things up over social media, and then they rushed 400 officers or whatever the number was downtown, and the time span they laid out was like 15 minutes, so that was an impossibility. So I just think that they were once again caught unprepared. And again, you know, the mayor doesn't want anybody asking really tough questions. You saw the press conference. I think there was, how many reporters were there? Was there one? And of course, he was the designated question, reporter to ask the questions. And, she was out there with the police commissioner. She gave her rationale, gave her explanation, gave us the rhetoric. And then when the reporter tried to ask a penetrating question, this was the penetrating question. It had to do with the Cook County State's Attorney Fox. She lashed out at him. Also lashed out, obviously, at Hopkins, who was asking legitimate questions.
You're talking about, speaking about Alderman Brian Hopkins.
Yes, Alderman Brian Hopkins.
Whose ward is downtown, that's been savaged by looters, et cetera.
Yeah, and Brian is Brian represents his ward well, and he's not a bombastic individual by any stretch of the imagination, and he hasn't been like one or two other aldermen. He hasn't been kind of a constant critic of the mayor, and of course, she doesn't want people to be asking her questions. So, she feels she'll make her statements, and then she tries to avoid the tough questions.
Jeff Carlin. Jeff Carlin keeps reminding me that on broadcast, you have to restate the issue. you know, because I figure everybody that's listening to the Chicago Way understands the dynamics and the players. You have to restay just to
a refresher. Refresher. Yeah.
So let's refresh. Lori Lightfoot endorsed Tony Preckwinkle's candidate for state's attorney, Kim Fox. Kim Fox is the George Soros candidate, took $2 million, accepted from George Soros-related PACs, as did other liberal prosecutors across the country. I made mention of it, and you know what happened then. Big controversy, right? John Cass, now on wherever I am, on page 22.
You're on the enemy's list.
Yeah, I'm on the enemy's list. But I'm still here, and I'm still barking. But not like some little dog. I'm a big dog. And here's the problem. Here's the issue I see politically. Lori Lightfoot smashed Tony Preckwinkle in the election, rolled her. Then she gets elected, and she begins to roll. She rolled to the CTU. We'll talk about that later. She endorsed Kim Fox. Kim Fox is part of this crew of people that believe in low bonds. Low bonds and, you know, basically not prosecuting as tough as predecessors. I don't think Jeff Carlin or me or you want people to be in jail for nonviolent crimes. But here's the problem. Kim Fox is letting people go, according to a Tribune analysis and other reporting. She's letting violent people go, and she's dropping cases against felony cases against violent people. So Lori Lightfoot, to back up, Lori Lightfoot has been trying to apply pressure on Kim Fox, maybe to get the pressure off her. And what she's been doing is sending out Police Superintendent David Brown at news conferences over the past several weeks, if not months, correct, Jeff Carlin? To raise the pressure and talk about, oh, these criminals should be arrested, criminals should be kept in jail, not released out on the streets by the prosecutors and the judges. With that as a backdrop, Craig Wall, after the mass rioting and the embarrassment to the city, with people ready to leave the city now, and many are leaving. So Craig Wall asked the natural question. You guys are talking about the prosecutor, so why don't you basically say her name? And she went crazy. She went crazy on Craig Wall and said, don't bait me. Now, do any of you people fish? Do you know what bait is?
Yeah, I fish.
You don't fish, Paul, because you can't sit still. I know. But listen. That's the thing is that Lori Lightfoot was baiting the city for weeks, having David Brown go out there and criticize unnamed prosecutors and judges when we all know what she's saying. So what does it mean in the political context? The question to both Jeff Carlin and to Paul Vallis, what does it mean when she walks right up to the line and then backs off and won't even say Kim Fox's name? What does that tell us?
Look, I don't think she likes criticism, I don't think she knows what she's doing, quite frankly. It's easy to blame Kim Fox, and Kim Fox deserves a lot of blame because, as the Tribune story pointed out, she isn't keeping dangerous individuals in prison. In jail. You know, I talk to police officers all the time, and they don't want to incarcerate. They don't want to incarcerate individuals who are nonviolent offenders. In fact, they've said that the diversion programs that they have for individuals with drug problems are woefully inefficient. They're the first to tell you that. So it's not like they want to lock everybody up, but clearly the statistics show that she's letting out individuals with records, dangerous individuals, no doubt about it. But, you know, look, they have a clearance rate of 20% on murders, a clearance rate this year of 20% on murders, even with their best attempts to kind of manipulate the data. You know, they're not making arrests. You can't prosecute what you don't arrest. And, you know, I talked during the course of the campaign, and I've done a number of polling since, about the need, about the total, about the convoluted reorganization of the police department, the elimination of the organized crime unit, which focuses on guns, drugs, and gangs, or for that matter, the elimination of the area saturation teams, which also include these supplemental police resources that the area commanders can draw on in an emergencies, or the fact that the detectives division is woefully overwhelmed, in part because there's so many murders that have been unsolved, but also in part because, if you remember, during the Emanuel administration, he gutted the detectives division and only just rebuilt it. But it's a detectives division that's overworked, overwhelmed, and it's a detectives division with a hell of a large number of new officers, of new detectives and inexperienced detectives. You know, I've been talking for the better part of 2 years about doing what other cities have done, which is to go out and to supplement the detectives' ranks with retired detectives who can come in and serve as analysts to help work cases. So, you know, the mismanagement and the ineffective use and deployment of police resources are a big part of the problem, too, because they're not arresting people. So it's just not Fox releasing people. It's the police department's inability to go out and then make arrests. And, you know, when you're in a community, when you're not arresting the criminals, and people in that community know that you're not arresting the criminals, people say that people in the community are afraid of the police. No, people in the community are afraid that the police cannot protect them. There, you remember the story, there was the little girl who 17-year-old, one of her cousins was shot and killed by a gangbanger, whatever he was, a drug dealer. I don't remember. Clearly, somebody with a record. And then she testified against him. And then he put a contract out, and they killed her. Pregnant teen, they killed her. Incidentally,
they killed the witness.
Yeah, she was a witness. She went back to that very same community, and she was killed. And I didn't see any marches, or I didn't see any protests. After that tragedy occurred, this is a pregnant 17-year-old teenager. And it was like, so the bottom line is the community is very, very fearful, and it undermines the ability of the police to do the work. And when you don't really embrace, community policing, when you don't maintain beat integrity where the cops are working those districts and they know the community, and when the cops are overwhelmed, and when the cops are being shifted in one direction or shifted another. First, we had a restoration of the violent reduction initiative where you just pull cops from beats all over the city, you dispatch them to the hot spots, and now we have this new version, eliminating all these support units like the area saturation teams, and now they have this special unit that they dispatch to the hot spots. The police are dazed and confused over the organization. They're under-resourced. They don't have the ability to work these murder cases. And then when you combine it with a state's attorney, you know, who is letting dangerous offenders out on the street, and in a state that can't get their act together to have a crime lab that's going to be responsive in real time and providing the results of DNA testing and things like that. I mean, it's like the perfect storm, and it's all those things in combination are contributing to the problem.
Let me pin you down. So do you think that what do you think of Lori Lightfoot egging her police superintendent on and then backing off at the last minute and being afraid or not mentioning Kim Fox's name? What about that specifically?
Well, you know, look, it just goes to show you that she's always looking for a scapegoat. And there's got to be a scapegoat. Look, in every weekend after there's been a violent incident, she's always tried to divert people's attention by having, you all remember violent weekend, the following Monday, we have the press conference. We have the Popcorn Gate or Coffee Gate press conference with Bobby Rush, accusing the police of loitering in his office, which, of course, they've never apologized for that because they were wrong. They were actually called to his office. And you remember, that got the news for 2 or 3 days. We had the release of the infamous Superintendent Johnson video, right after a particular violent weekend. One weekend they had a repeat of a press conference on the abatement of water bills and water fines and fees. It's the same press conference they had done 6 months earlier with the same cast of characters right after a particular violent weekend. I just think that clearly after an encore performance in the Loop, which is what that was, same similar mistakes, not responsive, not prepared, despite allegedly having the intelligence. And what do we have? I'm surprised they didn't release the Superintendent Johnson transcript or the superintendent report. No, they had to provide a more serious response or have a more substantive or more serious diversion. So they decided to beat up on Kim Fox. But then when confronted to basically say, are you criticizing Kim Fox? And she gets mad at the reporter who was asking the question. It's all dodging and weaving and avoiding the tough questions and looking for scapegoats. The bottom line is the police department, it's amazing that the police continue to go to work. Think about it. They've been operating for 3 years without a contract. They're on 12-hour work days. They're overwhelmed. They're constantly getting their off days and vacation times canceled, sometimes working 12, 14 days in a row. They get abuse. The rules of engagement significantly restrict their ability to access the resources that the normal police departments would have to deal with kind of mob actions, because that's what that was. And they get inconsistent support of the mayor's office. Yeah, she puts out, certain and she'll say things about how she supports the police department. But then we get Fingergate, if you remember, where police were getting criticized because police officers were exchanging what I call hand and arm signals with protesters. You know what I mean? Then we get
the Milwaukee skyline, Paul. You know what? I think if you had been mayor, you would have taught all the police at the police training academy, which they don't really have. They have to have them.
That's right.
You would have had a class on the Mutsa. Maybe you could have hired me and Jeff as special contractors. Because if you give the Mutsa, what is that? It's just, hi, how are you? Kind of, it's not the finger.
I also have to tell you something else. Clearly,
I guess he didn't like that one.
I didn't know how quite to respond to that, but it's early in the morning and for your listeners. But I want to make a point too. When Laquan McDonald died, they had 500 tasers in the entire police department, and New York had 15,000. And there was no excuse for police officers not having tasers. No excuse. No excuse for police officers not having tasers. Well, there's no excuse for not having working cameras. I'm sorry. How long have we been talking about working cameras? My son's...
Let's explain this, okay? Yeah. Jeff. The police department, after the rioting or looting... I said after the mostly peaceful protests. What am I supposed to say? After the rioting and looting downtown for the second time, destroying all those stores, tens of millions of dollars in damage, within plain sight of all the people down there. Here's what happened. The police came out with David Brown, superintendent, came out with a scenario that said there was a shooting in Englewood. The shooting was misreported by some kind of nefarious actors in the neighborhood as the killing of a young man, innocent killing, a police murder. I know that some police, some columnists still refer to the George Floyd. I thought somebody referred to the George Floyd police shooting, even though he wasn't shot by police.
Right.
So people make mistakes, but in this instance, it was framed as the shooting happened. People used it as pretext to go downtown and loot.
And what we found out was that there were no body cams on the special units that had been created to go down and, you know, and hit a hotspot. So they hit this hotspot. I think the unit 721, I'm not sure what the exact number is, but whatever they call it, they had no body cameras. So the police department, the city could not respond to the rumor mill that the police had killed a little boy or young boy. If they
the individual was 20 and they claimed that he was 15, et cetera. And
yeah, so but he was also shooting at police.
Yeah, exactly. And this individual had a record. And so do I believe the police? Yes. But you have to have the body cams. You know, like
right. So why don't they?
Well, that's a good question. You know, that look, 80% of the consent decree is a no-brainer. It's things that the police department should have been doing, from the supervisory ratios of sergeants, training officers, to the training that's required, to the tasers, to the body cams. That's a no-brainer. I mean, that's stuff that they should have been doing for years and they failed to do. So when she goes out there and she's going to scold Brown because they don't have working cameras, all I'm saying is thank God my boys have working cameras. You know, because
now
it is
us, open, because your boys?
Open, yeah, my boy.
Well, might not know this.
Both my boys. Our family has six veterans. At one time or another, four teachers, and of course, four police officers. My wife was a police officer. My two sons were police officers. My one son is now a firefighter. But thank God for the working cameras, because you know when they make arrests these days, they're looking for every excuse. You know, immediately they're going to charge police brutality. It's just common knowledge. And you know, thank God. My one son, and I'm not going to talk about who they are, what police departments they work for, had a body cam because he has that body cam. He uses that body cam. I always tell him, you know what, this is like a movie, and you're filming a movie, and what you need to do is everything you do with that body cam is designed to protect you and also to put that individual that you're stopping at ease, because they point out everything's being recorded. It puts that individual who gets arrested at ease, and knowing particularly if the person is stopped and he's, you know, and he doesn't have priors or whatever, or even if he does, I mean, he knows that what's going on is being recorded. And I remember my one son telling me that he had arrested somebody for beating, for a domestic abuse, for physically beating his wife, and he was put in the back of a car. And then as my son was taking off, the guy smashed his face against the plexiglass or whatever, the barrier, and then told him, I'm going to tell the judge that you hit me. And then my son just smiled and said, look at the camera, because everything that you did just now was recorded. You know, and I remember my other son, he stopped somebody and the guy wouldn't, you know, take his hands out of his pockets. And he was fearful that he had a weapon. So he had to put the guy on the ground, and he put him on the ground hard. And the guy complained, but there was that body cam. There was that body cam, you know, there to protect them. So there's no excuse. Beating up your superintendent, I mean, you ran on police accountability, and we still don't have working body cams. That's unacceptable. That is absolutely unacceptable. And that has to come from the top. That has to come from the mayor's office. That has to come from somebody who ran on the platform of police accountability to give these police officers working body cams. Because, you know, I did a post that got a lot of response, where I said it's time for the police officers for us to see the crime scenes, for us to see things through the eyes of the police officers, like the Columbus Day statue riot, which clearly was an assault and an attack on police. You know why? Because we had all the footage. We had the aerial footage from the condos that showed the cops that were being attacked by all sides, like a scene out of the Alamo. And we had the footage from the ground showing police officers, in some cases, because they weren't giving their riot gear, because they didn't want to create the negative image of police officers were having riot gear. So we had police officers that were ducking rocks and bottles and were defending themselves with bicycles, for crying out loud. But the point is, it was the cameras. It took them 3 days to say, yes, the police were not at fault. Yes, this was a riot. Yes, this was an attack on police. But clearly, the cameras, the video documentation was there. And so there's no explanation for that. That responsibility lays on the doorstep of the mayor. But these groups are going to look at any provocation, you know, individuals who get arrested are political prisoners or they're freedom fighters. The looting of stores, not only downtown, the looting of stores on the west side and the south side, because the following day there was more looting and more attacks on the west side. That's reparations. What happens when you go in? If it's reparations to destroy stores downtown, what do you call the destruction of stores on the south side and on the west side? Is that reparations? I mean, you're destroying stores owned by individuals in your community. Is that reparations? So at the end of the day, every excuse becomes or every police action, aggressive police action, is going to be a provocation, and it's going to be a rationalization to go out and to do damage and to loot and to have another looting fest. You saw the footage of individuals busting down doors and running out. They broke into one store, just to take a pause and to get refreshments, so to speak. So at the end of the day, if you know every incident's going to be a provocation, you better make sure you've got your working cameras. You got to better make sure that you're making that footage public and things like that. So I lay the fault on the doorstep of the mayor. I agree with Hopkins, Alderman Hopkins. They were unprepared. They were totally unprepared, and it should not have happened, given the fact that what happened was a encore performance of what had happened during the first looting fest. In Maine.
This was not an organized protest. Rather, this was an incident of pure criminality. This was an act of violence against our police officers and against our city. Criminals took to the street with the confidence that there would be no consequences for their actions. And I, for one, refuse to allow these cowardly acts to hold our city hostage. I pledge to pursue these offenders to the fullest extent of the law.
These individuals engaged in what can only be described as brazen and extensive criminal looting and destruction. And to be clear, this had nothing to do with legitimate, protected First Amendment expression. These were not poor people engaged in petty theft to feed themselves and their families. This was straight up felony criminal conduct. And to those who engaged in this criminal behavior, let's be clear. We are coming for you. We are already at work in finding you, and we intend to hold you accountable for your actions. I don't care. I do not care. Whatever justification was given for this, there is no justification for criminal behavior ever.
Yeah, we're back on the Chicago Way. Jeff Carlin, executive producer of the Rokan Show. John Cass, columnist, editorial board member, man who would not yield. I listen, I watch 300 Spartans every day. I watch it twice, the new one and the old one with Egan, Richard Egan, with the rubber tipped spears. Yeah, and we also have Paul Vallis, who was the candidate for governor and mayor, and he's coming out strong on Lori Lightfoot today on the Chicago Way. Paul, let's talk about schools for a second. We talked about crime. Schools. Should the schools be open?
You know, I believe that the schools should be open. I worked in New Orleans, as you know, after Katrina. I was asked to go down to New Orleans to take over the Recovery School District and reopen schools. And I actually went there a year and a half after Katrina because they just couldn't get schools open. The old public school system there was incapable of getting these schools open. So the state took over. I had responsibility. And we had kids who were returning to school 6 months, 8 months, a year after the hurricane. They had been out of school for that long. And I'll tell you, the damage was for many individuals, it couldn't be repaired. We have students who weren't a year behind. We have students who are 3 or 4 years behind. And students lose 20% of their previous year's knowledge that they had accumulated the previous year during a normal summer. I mean, the normal summer vacation is too long, particularly with children who are not going to be engaged and involved in summer activities and constructive summer activities and things like that. But to keep schools closed for 4, 5, 6 months and to be substituting it with this really abysmal remote instruction. You know, the Tribune did a story, John. I think it was either the Tribune or sometimes. They both did stories on just how unproductive the remote learning was. 40% of the kids tuned in 2 or fewer days a week, and it wasn't like they were tuning into synchronous instruction or live instruction. No, they were going online and getting stuff downloaded. I mean, it's just an abdication of responsibility. And
Well, I'm someone with pre-existing conditions. I have, people know they read the column. I have a serious condition now. I didn't anticipate it, but I guess it was all those Polish sausages I was eating in the car on stakeouts years ago, following politicians around. But whatever the case, I have to be careful about where I go.
Right.
So I'm not telling teachers, old teachers like me, with health conditions to go into the classroom. But
right.
I also have a son, and my wife is a teacher, and my son's a teacher. Special ed teacher, and he wants to be in school,
right?
Because he thinks, especially with special ed, that the kids need to be to have that contact with the teacher to help them. That's the best way to do it. Now the question is, how do you deal with the health issue?
Yeah, well, John, first of all, let me just. Point out that the damage is significant, and the CDC, points out in great detail that children are minimally impacted by the virus. In Illinois, of the 7,500 deaths that are COVID related, only 5 are individuals under the age of 20, and I'm sure they all had pre-existing conditions. And look, the loss of a single child is tragic and not acceptable. There is the issue of the transmission to adults, and although the CDC says at least the initial evidence indicates that the younger children don't readily transmit as older individuals do, I would still be skeptical about that data. But the point here is there are ways to make sure that schools are safe and secure. It's just not only following the CDC guidelines and the state guidelines about doing temperature screening and social distancing and scrubbing and cleaning and things like that. But there's other things you can do. So, for example, I posted something that basically said you can mask every child in the schools and actually provide the child with a and the teachers with a full facial screen. You can install these temperature checking kiosks so you're not even physically engaging in the individual to check the temperatures. And you can put plexiglass dividers to separate the teachers from the students, to surround every desk in transparent plexiglass like you're doing in Asia and a lot of European countries. And the cost for a single school of about 500 students and faculty would be $25,000. An average budget of a school of 500 is about $7.5 million. So you can install ultraviolet lamps that are now safe to kill all the pathogens in the schools. You can put them in the classroom. You can hook them up with your HVAC system, and they kill all the pathogens. That means the flu viruses and things like that. You can use foggers to supplement your school cleaning to 2 or 3 times a day, which can clean the bathrooms and clean the open spaces. The point is you can design a health safety plan that allows for the partial opening of schools. Clearly the district was not prepared. Clearly the district did not have the type of health safety plan that they could put forward to argue that schools were the safest place for kids and that schools could be the safest place for adults. Because what Denver's doing, for example, is teachers who, like students who don't want to come to school because they have pre-existing conditions and things like that, they're the ones who are working on the remote platforms. They're the ones providing remote teachers. So those are things that you could do. You know, I fault the unions because let's face it, there's been a national campaign not to open schools and to demand that instruction be done remotely. I mean, when you have the American Federation of Teachers giving their local chapters permission to violate their contracts and to make their own determination as to whether or not schools are safe and to strike if they don't feel that they're safe. Well, first of all, that's an abrogation of the contract. So, but at the end of the day, clearly there's been a campaign to do that. I say that you can make schools safe and secure for at least partial openings, but clearly I don't think the district had a real comprehensive plan, or at least a plan that they could openly argue would make the schools a safer place for these kids than sending the kids home unattended. Do you think these inner city kids are socially distancing or going home and wearing their masks? You know, look, my wife and I, she works for TSA, so we socially distance in our house. Now, how many immigrant families, how many low-income families can socially distance in their neighborhoods or can socially distance in their own house? You know, you have a lot of families. The poorer the families, the greater the likelihood that there's more than a single family, occupying a house or occupying an apartment. So
we got four in a two-bedroom apartment right now with beer filling the fridge. And I'm like, where's the space in the
Look,
in
I
the
grew
fridge?
Up with
guys,
there are generations right. in my household.
Yeah.
We have three generations in our household.
Right.
I mean, so let's face it. And who's watching and monitoring the kids? And think of the impact on working families. Think of the impact on working families. One in six blacks and Latinos can work remotely. One in six. That means they either don't go back to work and think of all the consequences of that, social, emotionally, just a whole array of consequences of not having parents working and struggling to make ends meet. And these federal relief checks are not going to last forever. So think about the consequences. Or the parents go to work and they leave their child home alone, maybe supervised by an older sibling. If they're so the schools are the safest place, but the district clearly did not make the case. So the unions were able to scare the living daylights out of people, but the district was also not prepared for remote instruction. I mean, they've had since May to know that there wasn't going to be a vaccine, that they were probably going to have to open, if not remotely, they would need to be prepared to operate remotely in the event that schools needed to close again. But they didn't have a plan. I mean, did you notice at the press conference, when they said they were going to remote instruction, and we still haven't seen the plan, they said that when they were going to remote instruction, they said that they were looking at what other cities have done, successful remote instructional programs in other cities. It's August. Schools are supposed to open in what, about after Labor Day? Is that 3 weeks? And you're looking at what other districts are doing? You're the third largest district in the country. I mean, you should be leading the way. School districts should be looking at what you're doing. You had a $7.7 billion budget last year, 54% of all property tax revenues that people pay, taxes that people pay in the city of Chicago, go to the schools. You get 25% of all the school funding that comes from the state. You get 40% of the Title I money. Trump just gave you $205 million in additional COVID money. You're going to get five times that amount if the Senator McConnell bill passes. Schools are going to get five times the amount that they got in the first round of COVID-19. And you don't have a remote plan? I mean, with that type of funding, every classroom could be synchronous. In other words, every classroom could be a virtual classroom where if students are not in class, they can watch that class being taught from their iPad, from their computer, or for that matter.
It would freak me out, Paul. It would freak me out if my kids were watching them take history. Right. Study history. I would probably
like it would say in the paper, John Cass is taking the day off because he's raging at what his kids were being taught. Right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Incomplete history, 1619 nonsense. Everything's racism. The whole country sucks. History is ideology and all that. But we have to get back to that at another time because we're running out of time.
Okay.
And you know what? Thanks for being here. So just to be clear, you're not running for mayor. You're calling out Lori Lightfoot and Kim Fox, and you think kids should be in school. Right?
That's right. That's right.
For Paul Vallis, my friend who grew up in Greek daycare like me, working it with his father since he was 10 years old.
I like that.
For Jeff Carlin, executive producer of The Rokan Show on WGN, my friend. And Jeff, you noticed all the people that called in to say they love you and your family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for me.
Yeah, it means a lot. The support is greatly appreciated.
We love you, man. And you and Christine and your whole family.
Me too. Absolutely.
And for me, John Cass, husband, father. You know what? Let's start over again. And for me, John Cass, Greek Orthodox Christian, husband, father, columnist, member of the Tribune's editorial board. Thanks for joining us on another edition of the Chicago Way on WGN+.